The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the third reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In Chapter 4, Jane started school at the Indiana School for the Blind and made a fast friend, which somewhat alleviated her profound homesickness. She met the governess, who was a complete stickler that all rules be followed. No hugs or sympathy would be coming from her. Jane very quickly learned Braille, and because of her progress, she was promoted mid-year to the next grade, where she was in the same class as the person who would one day become her husband, Mario. By age 11, her sight was completely gone. In chapters 6 and 7, we began to know more about Mario, the son of Italian immigrants. His mother, in particular, was never going to give up hope that Mario's blindness could not be cured, even when the pressure in his eyes became so great that one eye literally exploded. We were in mid-chapter when the book hour concluded, and Mario's mother had taken him to Italy in the belief that a faith healer not far from her home village would have the answer for Mario. Now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. After the joyous reunion, they walked to the wharves where the Re d'Italia was already moored. The captain rushed down the gangway to meet them, apologizing profusely for leaving them in Naples. He'd waited for 15 minutes, but had to leave without them. Apparently, Signora Peroni had misunderstood the departure time. Aletta was too tired and relieved to argue. She collected their belongings from the ship, and Rocco helped them load the trunk into a horse-drawn cart for the short trip to the train station. After a frightening journey from Naples to Genoa, Aletta was ready to relax on the 5-hour trip to Barga, the town closest to San Pietro. Since it was a hot summer day, every window in the crowded train car was open. Mario leaned against his mother while Charlie napped across the aisle next to his uncle. The wood-burning steam engine struggled to pull the long train uphill through the mountains. About halfway through one lengthy and very dark tunnel, the train jerked to a stop. Passengers began asking each other what was happening, but of course everyone was literally in the dark. There were no lights in the tunnel or the car. Men lit matches for a momentary glimpse of light, trying to ascertain why they were stopped. Thick, acrid smoke from the engine drifted in through the open windows, and people began coughing. As the smoke filled the car, Mario reached for the handkerchief in his pocket and put it to his nose. It was little protection from the choking air. He felt his mother reach for his free hand. She was trembling and could offer little comfort. His eyes watered, but he was unperturbed by the dark. He was getting hot, though, and breathing was becoming harder. Soon Aletta began praying quietly in Italian. Other women joined her. Some voices were tinged with panic. At the same time, men shouted and cursed angrily, demanding to know why they were stopped. As there was no way to communicate with the train's engineer, the passengers had no choice but to sit and wait in the smoky darkness. The prayers were comforting to Aletta, but she felt completely helpless in the hot, smoky air. It was pitch black, except for the occasional match that was lit and flickered for a few seconds. She called out to Charles and Rocco, asking if they were using their handkerchiefs. Their muffled answers assured her that they were trying to filter the air. Passengers were coughing, trying to breathe. Some were waving their hands in front of their faces. Others had newspapers to fan themselves. Finally, after several hours, the passengers felt a bump as the engine connected with the car's coupler. The train started up, and minutes later cleared the tunnel. Everyone cheered and clapped as fresh air flowed into the car and sunlight bathed the relieved passengers. Later, Aletta learned that the train was too heavy for the engine, so the engineer uncoupled part of the train and left it behind, while he took the front to the closest station and parked those cars on a sidetrack. Then he backed the engine slowly down the tracks to pick up the remaining stranded cars in the tunnel. After the harrowing experience, the family was exhausted but happy to be met at the station in Barga by Mario's paternal grandmother, Umiliana Peroni. "Aletta, Carlo, Mario," she called to them, smiling and waving as she hurried to them. After a long, joyful hug with Aletta, she squeezed Charlie and pinched his cheeks. Then Umiliana squatted down and looked carefully at Mario's eyes. She winced slightly at his enlarged eye and the empty socket, but said nothing. "Il mio bambino, my baby," she said while hugging him tightly. Caught up in her arms, Mario smelled the clean scent of Italian herbs. Her thin body felt soft and strong at the same time. Her arm muscles were strong from physical labor, yet he sensed a softness that radiated with love. When she took his hands, he felt the rough, calloused hands of someone who worked hard and was surprised that they felt even rougher than his mother's hands. Umiliana had borrowed a donkey and a two-wheeled cart to take them up to the village San Pietro in Campo. With the steamer trunk and luggage loaded onto the cart, there was just enough space for Aletta and the children. "Come, let's go home. I know you are all tired. Climb up and get as comfortable as you can," said Umiliana as she held onto the donkey's bridle. Mario sat next to his mother, leaning up against her tense body and feeling the cart sway over the rough dirt road. He listened to the clopping of the donkey's hooves as Umiliana led the donkey back to the village, the two-hour ride that was mostly uphill. After a while, he felt his mother begin to relax as they approached familiar surroundings. The rhythmic motion of the cart lulled Mario into a nap, which ended when the cart came to a stop at the family home in San Pietro. "We're here, Mario, wake up. Charlie, help get the smaller bags," Aletta said as she gathered her belongings and lifted her skirt to climb down. She was immediately enveloped in the arms of her sisters-in-law, Maria and Antonietta, crying and hugging in joyful reunion. Neighbors stopped their chores upon hearing the excited voices and came running to greet Aletta and to meet her children. Charlie and Mario, tired of traveling and wanting to explore their surroundings, tolerated the hugs and kisses until Charlie said, "Mom, can we go inside? We want to see our room." "Mario will stay with me in this house. There's not enough room for you to sleep here, so you'll have your own room in the rectory with your Uncle Rocco and Anna." "Who's Anna? And where's the rectory?" "Anna is your uncle's housekeeper. The rectory is part of an old monastery that is over 1,000 years old. You'll like it, and besides, you are only going to sleep over there. I lived there before I married your father. See, it's just across the street. We'll be very close by." "Okay, Mom, can we go now?" "Yes, listen for the church bell. Do you see it up there in the steeple? When it rings 6 times, it will be time for dinner." "Mario, let's go see Grandma's house," said Charlie, reaching for his brother's hand. Together they ran into the old stone house, but stopped short just inside the door. "What's that smell?" asked Mario. "Mario, you won't believe it. There are cows in here, and hay, and, oh, a pig, too. And manure, that's what I smell. Yuck! What are animals doing in this house?" "I don't know, but it seems there's a barn down here. Where does this door go?" Charlie asked as he opened the heavy, creaking wooden door. "There's a whole bunch of big barrels in here. It says vino on the side, so that must mean wine. Mom told me they made their own wine, and we get to help pick the grapes. And there are smaller barrels that say olio d'oliva. I think that's olive oil. Come here, you can touch the barrels to see the difference. It's cool down here, and I can't feel the sun. There must not be any windows," said Mario, as he put his arms around the olive oil barrels. "These barrels aren't very big. Let me see the other ones." Mario ran his fingers on the wood, carefully avoiding splinters. "These barrels are a lot bigger," he said, as he tried to put his arms around the container. "I can't even get my arms around it. Grandma sure has a lot of wine. Do you think they'll give us any?" No, silly. That's why they have cows. We have to drink milk. Let's get out of here. The boys ran up the stairs to the next level, where they found the main living area anchored by a kitchen and a large fireplace, which was used for cooking and also served to heat the 800-year-old house. There were two small bedrooms off to the side. They were rented out to a young widow, her daughter, and two sons. She and the children chopped wood, cared for the animals, plowed the fields, and harvested the crops in return for room and board. After a cursory inspection of that level, Charlie and Mario went up to the next floor and found three bedrooms. Their aunts, Antonietta and Maria, shared one. Emiliana had the largest, and Mario and Aletta would share the third room. Each room was simply furnished. An iron bed stood next to a small wood table, and since there were no closets, there was a plain armoire against one wall. On the table stood two metal candlesticks with candles that had been burned down to short stubs. Simple pieces of white cloth served as curtains, covering one tall, narrow window in the room. A crucifix of Jesus was displayed prominently on the wall of each room, an overt reminder of their Catholic faith. "Charlie, where's the toilet? We haven't found it yet," said Mario. "It must be behind this door," Charlie answered as he opened it. "Yes, it's here, but it doesn't look like what we have at home. It smells awful. Did someone forget to flush it?" "That's the thing. It's just got an old wood seat, but there's no water, and you can't flush it." "Phew! It stinks. Well, how do you use it?" "Ew! I'm going to have to hold it for a long time. It's awful in here." "I see a pipe that goes down somewhere. Let's go see where it comes out." The boys ran down the flight of stairs while their grandmother watched with a smile. She knew they'd discovered the primitive toilet and would soon be back with questions. Minutes later, Charlie and Mario were back, looking confused. "Grandma," said Charlie, "we looked everywhere but couldn't find that pipe. Where does it go?" "Do you know what a cistern is?" she asked. "Well, we have one at home that holds water," said Charlie. "Well, there's a cistern under the house. The pipe goes down into it. Every year in the springtime, we take buckets and empty it out. Then we dump the buckets on the fields and spread it around for fertilizer. It makes everything grow. And in the summer, we get delicious tomatoes. And next spring, you both will get to help with the buckets." Charlie looked at his grandmother in disbelief, while Mario wrinkled his nose at the prospect of that dirty job. Laughing, Emiliana looked down at her grandchildren and said, "Don't worry, bucket season is a long way off. Go out now and find Charlie's bedroom at the monastery. Uncle Rocco will be waiting for you." In September, after Charlie began the third grade in the village school, Aletta took Mario to Florence, where a doctor examined him. "I'm sorry, Signora Baroni, but I'm afraid that young Mario has glaucoma. It's very rare to find glaucoma in a child this young," said Dr. Rizzo in Italian. "His optic nerve has been damaged, and there's nothing I can do to fix it. The operation he had in the United States, even though done with the best of intentions, made things worse." "Maybe you have some medicine that will help," said Aletta. "There's no medicine, no eye drops, no operation that will bring back his vision. I know that the American doctors have tried many things. I wish that I could help." Tears began rolling down her cheeks. Aletta struggled to comprehend that her worst fears were coming true. "You're saying that he'll be blind for his whole life? How do you know? Maybe there will be a miracle, and one day he'll be able to see." Dr. Rizzo stood up and put one hand on her shoulder. "Signora Baroni, you're right. We can always pray for a miracle. Meanwhile, take Mario home and allow him to be a boy. Let him do things that his brother does. Mario is a very bright boy. Make sure he goes to school. He might surprise you." Mario was not upset with the news that his eyes could not be fixed. He was happy that the doctor said not to waste more time or money on seeing other doctors, and was especially relieved that he would not have to endure any more stinging eye drops. He was ready to go on with his life, even if his mother was reluctant to accept the doctor's advice. Smiling, Mario said, "Mom, can we go home now?" The doctor said, "I don't need any medicines or eye drops. I want to go home and play with Charlie." Returning to San Pietro in Campo, Aletta was devastated, but unwilling to give up on prayer, the only thing that gave her hope. She took Mario to many roadside shrines in the area. Most were statues of the Virgin Mary or beautiful icons painted of Mary and baby Jesus. The nearby town of Barga alone had 10 shrines, which they visited, often taking flowers as an offering. They knelt before the statues. Mario fidgeted while his mother prayed for a miracle. He obediently waited for his mother to finish praying, but he couldn't wait to get back home to play with Charlie. His blindness didn't bother him. He didn't remember being able to see. It was just a fact of life. He wished his mother wouldn't be so upset about him, but he didn't know how to comfort her. When his eyes didn't change, Aletta decided to take him to a faith healer who had a reputation for helping believers. They walked up the mountain trails a mile to the woman's home. Even though Mario enjoyed the time with his mother, he was silently dreading what the faith healer might do to him. He hoped that she wouldn't put anything that stung into his eyes. Upon their arrival at the woman's home, she took him to a shed where piles of chestnuts were being dried on the floor. Chestnuts were a favorite treat in Italy and were often roasted over the fireplace while neighbors gathered to enjoy each other's company and drink wine. Mario accidentally stepped on some, which produced a loud crunching sound that startled him. He was relieved when the woman said nothing. She directed him to sit on a wooden chair. Taking a crucifix from the wall, the woman handed it to him and said, "Hold this, child." Not knowing what she wanted him to hold, Mario obediently took the sacred object. Using his fingers to feel the object, he traced the body of Christ hanging from the cross and recognized it as a crucifix. The healer placed her hands over the boy's eyes and began incanting a long prayer in a language he didn't understand. She raised her voice and then dropped it dramatically while murmuring repetitive phrases. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity to the child, she stopped and removed her hands from his eyes. Satisfied, she put her hands on his and looked at his eyes for confirmation of the miracle. "What can you see?" she asked. "Nothing, just a little light. Can we go now?" Mario wasn't surprised that the woman didn't cure him. He felt a little embarrassed by all the attention, even though he was only 6 years old. He didn't have faith in the woman. His blindness didn't bother him. It only distressed his mother. He knew that his parents worried about him, but as long as he had Charlie, he was happy. Distraught that her last resort was unsuccessful, Aletta continued to pray for a miracle. She wrote long letters to Antonio, telling him of her efforts and sadness that no one had been able to help their son. They wrote of their fears for their son's future. How would he make a living? She'd seen beggars on the streets in Florence. Would her son be a beggar? How could he go to school if he couldn't see to read? What would she do with him all day? The parents decided to make any sacrifice necessary so that Mario would not want for anything when he grew up. Antonio vowed to work even longer hours to be a successful store owner. Aletta promised to help by working there on Saturdays, making pork tenderloin sandwiches and waiting on customers. A year after arriving in Italy, the family returned to Muncie and the new, larger home that Antonio had bought while they were gone. He turned the house into a duplex, renting out the upstairs. It was closer to the store than the previous house and provided a new neighborhood for the boys to explore. Antonio and Aletta talked with Charlie, telling him that since Mario would never be able to see, he needed to look after his brother and include him in his play as much as possible. They wanted Mario to live a full life, and Charlie would play a key role. He would be responsible for Mario's safety. As a young boy, Charlie never imagined how much of an influence he would have on Mario's life. He accepted his role with verve and imagination, often leading his younger brother on adventures best not revealed to their parents. Chapter 8. Mario Goes to School. St. Lawrence Catholic School, which Charles attended, refused to admit Mario to the first grade because he was blind. The principal didn't want to give special attention to one child, believing that it was unfair to the other children. She had no recommendations for alternative education and left the clear impression that it would be a waste of time to try to educate him. He could never earn a living, so why bother teaching him academic subjects? However, perhaps feeling obliged to save his soul, the principal agreed that Mario could attend school only for catechism class. Charles would walk with him to school, and afterward the teacher would assign a male classmate to walk him home. But twice weekly catechism class hardly made up for the long, lonely days that Mario spent wishing that he could go with Charlie to school. Every weekday he followed his mother round the house, bored with nothing to do. Aletta didn't think that he could help her do the chores and had no time to entertain or read to Mario. Mario missed his brother, often dogging Aletta and asking several times a day, "When will Charlie get home?" The nun, who hadn't even interviewed Mario, thought that a blind child was impossible to educate. But Antonio and Aletta knew how quickly he learned and had seen his keen interest in the world around him. While dismayed at the principal's attitude, they became determined to help their son get an education. 2 years later, when Mario was 8 years old, Antonio learned from a friend about the Indiana School for the Blind. Because it was 55 miles away in Indianapolis, Mario would need to stay in a dormitory during the week. Aletta was uncertain about her young son spending so much time away from home with strangers. He was only 8. She couldn't tuck him into bed at night, nor cook good Italian food for him. And what if he got sick? She couldn't take care of him. It pained her to think that he would be gone for days at a time, returning only on the weekends. When Antonio and Aletta told their son about the school, he didn't understand the implications of living far from home, but he jumped at the chance to learn reading and writing. Instinctively, Mario knew that it was a time for him to get an education, even though it meant leaving home and his adored older brother. Mario had never met another blind child, and while he was happy playing with Charlie and his friends, he was excited to make new friends. Very early on his first day of school, in September 1922, Mario and Aletta walked to the interurban station and boarded the train. Aletta spoke little English and felt uncomfortable taking Mario by herself, so her friend, Mrs. Huffer, joined them on the train. She would help them find the school and get Mario settled. During the ride, Mrs. Huffer gave Mario a little gold ring with his initial, M, on it. He was very proud of it and kept it as a favorite lifelong possession. Upon arrival at the school, Mrs. Huffer helped Aletta with the paperwork while Mario sat on a chair and anxiously swung his legs. The school smelled clean, like the floors had been mopped with bleach. He wondered where the dining room was. He couldn't smell food and cooking and was getting hungry. He hoped that it wouldn't be long before lunch. His mother's soft voice echoed off the plaster ceiling and walls, telling him that he was in a large room. The school seemed like a very big place, much larger than anything he'd experienced in Muncie. How would he ever find his way around? He shuddered as he pictured himself walking aimlessly, alone through the long halls, not knowing where he was or how to find help. Heavy footsteps came from his right. A deep male voice said, "Hello, Mrs. Peroni. I'm Superintendent Wilson. I'm so pleased to meet you." Turning to Mario, who stood up when the man announced himself, he continued, "And you must be Mario. Welcome to the Indiana School for the Blind." Mr. Wilson took Mario's hand and gently shook it. Thank you, said Mario. We're glad to have you with us, Mario. I know that you'll like it here. I bet that you would like to see your room. Miss Johnson will be your governess. She will show you to your room. You'll have 5 roommates. All of them are nice boys, your age. I'll let you get settled in now. Mario held his mother's hand as they walked past classrooms, the dining hall, and the gym. He thought that he'd never find his way around this gigantic school. He was already lost. They'd walked down one long corridor, turned right, went down another hall, and up a wide flight of stairs. After he felt they'd walked a mile, they finally arrived at his new room. Here we are, Mario. Your bed is over by the window. You have a chest of drawers next to it. That's where you will keep your clothes, said the governess. Your roommates aren't here right now, but you'll meet them soon. I'll let your mother and Mrs. Huffer get you settled. Aletta and Mrs. Huffer unpacked his suitcase and made his bed, while Mario stood by the open window, listening to the distant sound of children's voices on the playground. He missed playing with Charlie and their friends in Muncie. He didn't know anybody at the school, and soon he'd be left all alone. Mario, come here, Aletta said. I want you to see where I put your clothes. Mario followed the sound of her voice and lightly touched his bed as he walked obediently to his mother. Here's the top drawer. I put your underwear and socks in there. Mario dutifully put his hands in the drawer, feeling the soft fabrics and noting their location. Your shirts are in the next drawer, and your pants are in the bottom drawer. You know how to dress yourself. They won't help you here with your bath or brushing your teeth. I know, Mom. I'm 8 years old. I can take care of myself. Aletta smiled at Mrs. Huffer. She knew that her son was strong-willed, but leaving him here in care of strangers was almost unbearable. She dreaded saying goodbye, knowing that Mario would be upset when she had to leave. It would be hard to comfort him while choking back tears. She hesitated, looking around the room, and wondered how the governess managed to get all 6 boys to sleep. She hoped that Mario would make friends with them. When there was nothing left for them to do, Aletta hugged her son tightly, and Mrs. Huffer patted him on the head. "Mom, don't go," sobbed Mario as he reached for his mother. "Don't leave me here. I want to go back with you." Aletta struggled to hold back her own tears. How could she leave behind her terrified, blind son with strangers? She began to waver. Mrs. Huffer looked at her sternly and said, "Aletta, we need to go now or we'll miss the train." "Goodbye, Mario. I'm sure you'll do just fine. Your governess is here and she'll help you." "No, no, Mom, please take me with you." "Goodbye, Mario. I'll see you on Friday. That's not far away." The woman turned and left him in the care of the unknown governess, the sounds of his cries echoing down the institutional hallway. While Weekend's home had seemed like a good compromise to Aletta, she hadn't anticipated the emotional costs involved. Every Friday, Mario got excited to come home. But every Monday morning, he was miserable, and so were his parents. Mario cried inconsolably and begged his parents not to go back. When that didn't work, he complained that he was sick with a stomach ache. "Mom, I'm sick. I can't go back to school," said Mario with the appropriate moaning sounds meant to convince his mom that he needed to stay home. Aletta had to decide quickly if his pain was real or if it was his imagination. She didn't want to miss the interurban. But what if he really was sick? She couldn't take him to school sick. Aletta touched his forehead. "I don't think you have a fever. I can't keep you home. We have to hurry now to get to the train," she said. Disappointed, Mario picked up his small suitcase and put on his coat. The weekly ritual was exhausting to Aletta. Antonio complained that it was taking too big of a toll on her and Mario. It irked him that Aletta was spending so much on the train fares. 2 round trips for 2 people every weekend was adding up. They decided to make a deal with Mario for the 2nd grade. For every weekend that he'd stay at school, they would put the train fare into a bank account for him. That was a big incentive for him to stay, and it turned out to be much easier emotionally since he didn't have the Monday morning tears upon leaving home. By the time he'd reached sixth grade, he didn't go home for weeks at a time. The campus consisted of four buildings, and Mario was overwhelmed at first. There was no one to walk with him or guide him to class or even to the bathroom. He was on his own. At home, he knew the names of every street in his neighborhood and which direction they went. But the campus was confusing until he asked a teacher which direction each building faced. Armed with that information, he oriented himself. Being aware of his location and the direction he was headed was key to not getting lost, either in school or later as an adult traveling the streets of a big city. In 1922, the students at Indiana School for the Blind spent little time in their dorm rooms, using their rooms only for sleeping. They were required to stay downstairs in the sitting rooms when not in class. The sitting rooms were two adjoining rooms with tables and chairs. The governess, or her assistant, watched over the students as they read or played games, making sure that they behaved. In good weather, they played outdoors. They spent hours on the playground swings and often teamed up to play a game called Run Under. One child sat on the swing, while another one pushed him up so high that he could run under him. The object for the child on the swing was to go as high as he possibly could. Mario loved to swing and feel the air in his face and hair. He imagined that he was flying, feeling a freedom that was impossible when he was on the ground. As he got a little older, roller skating became a popular activity. The grounds had extensive walkways that were perfect for skating, though the boys were limited to their side of the campus. They dared not cross over the line to the girls' side, as contact between the sexes was strictly forbidden. Mario learned every bump, every inch of the sidewalks, and rarely fell. His noisy skate wheels rolled on concrete, creating echoes that bounced off the covered walkways and building walls. By listening carefully to the acoustics, he could tell if he was close to a building or under a walkway. Holding hands with a friend, they went in and out in round columns around the outside of the main building. They felt fearless. On a cold but sunny winter day, the noon lunch bell rang, signaling that it was time to line up for lunch in the dining room. "Arthur," said Mario, "I want you, Melvin, and William to sit with me. We can plan what we'll do after school today." The boys hesitated, unsure of what to say. Melvin and William, who had some vision, looked wistfully at each other, while Arthur scuffed his shoe as he tried to think of a reply. Finally, Arthur said, "We can't sit with you. We sit over at another table in the corner." "Why not? You just sit by yourselves in the corner with nobody else?" asked Mario. "We just have to sit there, after all," said Melvin. "Well, I don't understand why you can't sit with me. That's just plain dumb." "Leave it alone, Mario. We're used to it. We have our own room, too. They don't want us in with the white boys." Mario, who had never been exposed to racial prejudice, finally understood what they were trying to tell him. They couldn't sit together because of their skin color. Instinctively, he knew that that was wrong. But since his friends seemed to accept the situation, he reluctantly accepted it as well. After experiencing his mother's savory Italian cooking, Mario found it hard to stomach the plain institutional food. Breakfast was cornflakes and sometimes canned fruit. For lunch and dinner, there was often stringy beef with watery gravy, boiled potatoes, and canned fruit for dessert. The beef was difficult to eat. Cutting it took a lot of effort, especially with the dull knives given to the children. The thin gravy dripped on his shirt, no matter how hard he tried to avoid getting himself dirty. If he couldn't stomach the main course, he had a peanut butter sandwich. The cottony white bread at school was tasteless, but a peanut butter sandwich was better than being hungry. Nothing was as filling as his mother's warm, freshly baked bread. A wave of homesickness passed over him as he remembered the smell and taste of her bread. Despite the unappetizing food and lack of vegetables, Mario was healthy most of the time. But if he did catch a cold or didn't feel well, he didn't tell anyone. There were no doctors nor nurses on staff. The standard treatment for any malady was a dose of salts administered by the governess. Getting a dose of Epsom salts in warm water was worse than the original illness, but it was a strong laxative. Mario suffered the consequences of one dose the first time he complained of a headache. He resolved never to complain again. If someone became more seriously ill, he was taken to the top floor and put in isolation. That frightened Mario, as he couldn't think of anything worse than being stuck alone in a room with nothing to do but be sick. It reminded him of when he was 4 years old and sick with the flu during the 1918 influenza epidemic. Public health officials warned that the flu was extremely contagious and deadly, with thousands of people around the world dying every day. Despite it being February, Aletta made a bed for him out on the cold sleeping porch. She was terrified that the other family members would get sick. Although she tried to do her best to care for him, she was afraid to spend too much time with her sick child. Sick with a fever and body aches, Mario hated being isolated on the porch with nobody to talk to or comfort him. He used his vivid imagination to entertain himself, since books were of no use to him and radio broadcasts were not yet established. He missed running and playing with Charlie. For the 2 weeks it took him to recover, time moved very slowly in his dark world. It wasn't surprising that when he contracted measles during the sixth grade at the school for the blind, he panicked at the thought of being forced into a sick room and isolated. Based on his experiences with the governess and her assistants, he knew that he'd receive only minimal care. He wanted to be at home where his mother could take care of him. Mario had a fever and could feel the raised bumps of the rash on his body. He knew that he needed to get home before the governess saw the rash or suspected that he was ill. He called his father at the store, who left immediately for Indianapolis and brought him home. As an adult, Mario sometimes wondered how many people he'd exposed on the train to this serious virus, but at the time, he wasn't concerned about others. He was relieved to be with his father and would soon be home in his mother's loving care. It would take 2 weeks for Mario to recover, but he was grateful to be in his own bed, reading Braille books to help pass the time. Chapter 9. Adventures with Charlie. The noise of the crane's engines, its grating gears and screeching metal, as it worked to lift heavy steel beams, was exciting to Mario. It sounded powerful to the blind 10-year-old, who imagined the beams dangling in the air and caught by the men he heard yelling high above him. He'd played with his older brother's erector set, a construction set that allowed him to understand gears, beams, and pulleys. He'd felt the grooved edges of circular shapes and assembled long, narrow metal beams with nuts and bolts. But standing yards away from the life-sized action was much more interesting than playing on the living room floor. He loved the sparkling sound of the welder's torches as they connected beams to form another floor of the building. Turning his head in different directions changed the sound. He was never bored down at the construction site, just a block away from his home on East Charles Street. Topping out at three floors, the new YWCA seemed as tall as a skyscraper to Mario and his then 13-year-old brother. In the summer of 1924, the boys often stood on the sidewalk next to the site, their necks sore from straining to look up at the workers. When the framework was finished in July, the steel girders resembled a jungle gym and gave Charlie an idea. "Hey, Mario," he said one evening, "let's climb up to the top. I'll show you how this thing is built." "But aren't there any workers there?" "No, the workers are gone for the day. We won't get caught." Mario, who adored his older brother and never turned down an adventure with him, readily agreed to the ascent. He reached for his brother's elbow and lightly grasped it. The boys carefully made their way through construction debris to a ladder leaning against the building. "I'll go first, Mario. You stay right behind me. It's pretty tall, maybe even 16 feet," said Charlie as he began to climb up the creaky wooden ladder. "Okay, I'm coming," Mario said, reaching with his right hand for the next rung of the ladder. Concentrating on listening to his brother climb, Mario kept pace. Sweat trickled down his face, causing a tickle, but he didn't pause to wipe it away. He wanted to stay close to his brother. Soon he'd heard Charlie stop and felt the ladder jiggle as Mario dismounted. "All right, Mario, you're at the top of the ladder. Step to your right, and I'll make sure that you don't fall." Mario extended his right foot, testing the wooden platform before putting his whole weight down. Charlie took his hand, steadying him, then said, "Good. Now take my arm and we'll go to the next ladder." "You mean we have another ladder to climb? I thought the first one would take us to the top." "We have two more ladders if we want to get to the top. Remember, there are three floors. We've got a lot more climbing to do." Charlie hesitated. "Are you afraid?" "Oh, no, I'm not scared. Show me to the next one. I want to get to the top." Mario had no fear of falling. He felt safe, complete trust in his brother. "Okay, let's go. Follow me, just like you did before." The boys continued their climb, the sun beating down on them that Saturday afternoon. Mario again concentrated on listening to his brother's movements and was relieved when Charlie stopped for the last time. Charlie breathed heavily, both from the effort and the concentration on watching his brother. "Mario, we made it. We're at the top. Get off just the way you did before." Concentrating on his instructions, Mario successfully dismounted and stood still to catch his breath. A warm breeze whistled through the structure. "Oh, that wind feels good. I'm hot from all that climbing. What do you see, Charlie?" "Lots of beams that go in all different directions, and there are no walls or ceiling yet, so I can see lots of trees back toward our house. And there's downtown. I can see pretty far away. Now, what are we going to do? Climb back down?" "No, let's stay up here for a while. We should sit and rest." "Okay, where do we sit? Are there any chairs?" Charlie chuckled. "There aren't any floors, so we'll just go sit on one of these beams." "You mean there's no place to walk except on a beam? How are we going to do that? Aren't we awfully high? If I fall, there's no place for me to land." "Well, you'd land in the basement. But don't worry, I won't let that happen. Let me show you how wide the beam is. Squat down and put your hand right here," said Charlie. He took Mario's hand and placed it on the warm beam. He used both hands to explore the width and depth of the steel. "That's not very wide," he says. "It feels like it's only a few inches across. How are we going to walk on it?" "We're not going to walk. We'll crawl on all fours. You put your left hand on my hip. I'll go slowly." Mario did as he was told, working to maintain his balance with only one hand as he crawled along the narrow surface. Charlie stopped and said, "Let's sit here. This is a good place. I can see lots of buildings." The boys slowly lowered their hips to the girder, then swung their legs over the side, laughing as their legs dangled in the air. Holding tightly to the beam, Mario moved his head back and forth as he listened for sounds that were different at that height. "I hear a train, Charlie. It sounds like a big freight engine. I bet that's Nickel Plate train, way over near South Walnut Street. It's getting closer, so it must be moving fast," said Mario. "What else can you see from up here?" "Oh, I can see a long way," said Charlie. "There's the St. Lawrence Church steeple. It's tall and goes up to a point. There's a cross at the very top." Turning his head toward downtown, he said, "And I can see the Roberts Hotel. It's even bigger than this building will be. I'll count the number of stories. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Wow, that is tall. I can see all the way to the courthouse, too." Charlie wanted to show Mari exactly how high they were and finally had an idea. "Mario, I want you to listen." He hacked up a big glob of spit and let it loose. After a long moment, Mari exclaimed, "I heard it. That's a long way down there. It must be in the basement. That's how high we are. Don't fall off because you'll be down there with the spit." "I'll be careful," Mario said with a shudder, then coughed up his own spit and listened for the splat. Mario felt alive with the thrill of conquering the building. He was, quite literally, on top of his world. "Mario, I'm getting hungry. Let's go down now." Mario again placed his hand on his brother's hip and followed him slowly along the girder to the interior where the ladders were located. Climbing down was easier and faster than the ascent. They were home before supper, with their parents none the wiser. They were not caught in the act, but word of it got back to their father. "Antonio, I tell you, those boys were at the very top, and Mario could have fallen off," said their neighbor. "You're crazy to let your blind boy and Charlie climb around on that building." Antonio was unfazed by the report. "Mario is safer than Charlie because he has to use all his wits not to fall. I won't tell him that he can't do something that his brother can do. How will he learn if he sits around the house all day?" Chapter 10. Lessons. The sun beat down unmercifully on Charlie, Mario, and two neighbor boys. Tired of playing marbles on the sidewalk that was hot even in the shade, Charlie said, "Hey, boys, let's go swimming in the old gravel pit." "But I don't know how to swim," said Mario. "And besides, Dad said it's too dangerous to go down there. It's really deep. And he said there are no trespassing signs. What if we get caught?" "You're only 10 years old. They won't do anything to you. They'll just tell us to go home," said Charlie. "And remember, you were worried about getting caught while we climbed up the YWCA. Nothing happened there, and more people could have seen us." "I wish that we could just swim in the White River. It's not deep," answered Mario. "That river is really dirty. Nobody swims in it. The gravel pit isn't that deep. Come on, Mario, let's go. I'll teach you how to swim." "But how will we get there? It's too hot to walk that far," complained Mario. "I know a shortcut. Come, take my elbow and I'll show you. You love trains, don't you? We're going to the railroad bridge over the river. Then it won't be a long walk and we can jump into the cool water." "The railroad bridge? You mean we'd walk on the train track over the river?" Although he and Charlie had walked many times on train tracks, he'd never attempted crossing a trestle over water. It sounded almost as scary as swimming in the forbidden gravel pit. "Charlie, what if a train comes when we're in the middle? We could be killed." "Mario, quit worrying. I have a plan. We'll be fine. Let's go. I'm tired of being hot." Trusting his beloved brother, Mario took Charlie's elbow and the four boys set off on their adventure, walking several blocks to the tracks. Finding no trains, they walked between the rails on the wooden ties until they approached the river. Ignoring the no trespassing signs prominently displayed, the boys stopped at the edge of the trestle and waited for Charlie's directions. "Mario, we're at the bridge. I don't hear any whistles, but I can't see very far away because there are curves on both sides. Here's what you'll do. We'll watch for trains, but you put your ear down on the track and listen. See if you can hear a train coming." Obediently, Mario lay down on the rail and listened. Seconds later, hearing no rumbling train, Mario said, "I don't hear anything. There's no train coming." "Let's go," said Charlie as he grabbed his brother's hand to help him up. The boys started crossing the river, stepping carefully on the ties. There were no railings to prevent them from falling 30 feet down into the river. "I can see the water way down there, Mario," said Charlie, occasionally looking behind them for an approaching train. Mario shuddered and was glad he couldn't see how high up he was. "What if a train came along when they were in the middle of the trestle? What would I do?" he thought. Mario decided that he'd quickly stick his legs over the side and hang there until the train passed. He wasn't sure that would save him, but he could always jump off and into the water. He'd rather drown than get smashed by a steam engine. Once across the river, they hiked about 3 miles to the gravel pit. They snuck under the rusty gate, ran to the water's edge, and stripped off their clothes. The older boys jumped in, squealing with delight at the freezing water. "How deep is the pit? Is it mined?" asked Mario. "No, this old pit hasn't been used in years. Nobody will catch us. And it is deep, real deep. But don't worry. Come on, Mario. I'll teach you how to swim," said Charlie. Mario had complete trust in his brother. He learned to put his face in the water and kick his feet. That lesson was the start of a lifelong love of swimming, something that Mario did whenever he had the chance. Charlie began working at his father's confectionery store when he entered high school. Within a year, he saved enough money to buy a used jalopy, a 1921 Ford touring car, for $15. In 1925, there was no minimum age for driving, and driver's licenses weren't invented yet, so Charlie taught himself to drive at age 15. Antonio wasn't interested in driving and never wanted a car, but he did insist that his son insure it for $20. One summer afternoon, Charlie asked Mario if he'd like to go for a ride. 12-year-old Mario happily put down his Braille book that he'd been reading and jumped out of his chair. "Let's go," he said. "Do you want to drive?" Charlie asked, startled but always up for a challenge. Mario replied, "Sure, but I don't know how to drive." "Don't worry, I'll teach you. Come around the driver's side," he said while opening the door. "It's lucky that this car is a convertible and we don't need the roof. You don't have to worry about banging your head. Now put your foot on this running board," said Charlie, tapping the metal so Mario could find it with his hands. Mario climbed up and settled into the driver's seat. "I found the steering wheel," Mario said, feeling the warmth of the smooth wood as he ran his hands around the big circle. "How do I steer this thing?" "It's easy. I'll stand behind you in the rumble seat so I can see everything. I'll tell you which way to turn by tapping on your shoulder. But first, I want to show you the pedals. The accelerator is by your right foot. Reach down and you can feel it. You push that with your foot. The harder you push, the faster it will go. Now reach over to your left and feel the brake. It's up a little higher than the other one." "I found it. Let me practice with my feet." Mario used one foot for each pedal, experimenting with pressure needed to make the pedal move. "Okay, I'll start her up," Charlie said as the car roared to life. He hopped into the rumble seat behind Mario and put one hand on each of Mario's shoulders. "Feel my right hand, Mario. If I want you to angle right, I'll push a little on your right shoulder. The same with going left. I'll push on your left shoulder. But if you need to make a sharp turn, I'll push harder, like this." Mario felt the unmistakable pressure of his brother's hand on his shoulder and yelled in pain. "Ow! You don't need to push that hard. You want me to turn right?" Mario practiced turning the wheel. "I'll tell you how fast to go. And when I want you to stop, I'll push down on both shoulders. Ready?" "Ready," Mario said as he gingerly pushed on the pedal and the car jerked forward. "Whoa, I'm driving!" His face alit with glee, and he turned to his brother and said, "Where are we going?" "How about out in the country? It's a real pretty day. Go right up here at Main Street," Charlie directed as he gently pushed on Mario's right shoulder. There was little automobile traffic, though they dodged assorted hazards such as wandering dogs and children playing in the street. They slowly made their way out to a quiet country road lined with corn and hayfields. Mario turned around and said to his brother, "What do you see, Charlie? Anything interesting?" Charlie opened his mouth to respond, but was interrupted by the shrill call of a woman gardening in her yard by the road. "Young man! I suggest you keep your eyes on the road." As the car passed, Charlie replied, "Oh, he doesn't need to watch the road." Mario drove on with a big grin on his face, leaving a very puzzled woman behind. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.